Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Haunted, on ghosts, witches, vampires, zombies, and other monsters of the natural and supernatural worlds, by Leo Brody. Narrated by Perry Daniels. Preface. Who doesn't know the stories? The corpses rising from the grave, the blood-sucking vampires that fly by night, the man-made creature who turns against his creator and murderously stalks the land, the gigantic beast bent on annihilating anything human, the man who has found the magic potion that turns him into a monster. They're as familiar as the story of Moses leading the Israelites out of Egypt, or the crucifixion, or the hegira, or the Buddha teaching under the Bodhi tree. But instead of the foundational stories of a religion, they are stories of horror and terror that have generated more and more monsters as they are told and retold over the centuries. They aren't just in books or movies. They are under the bed, or they leap out of the closet. They scrape on the window in the dead of night, and they reside patiently in the attic, in the basement, in every patch of darkness and shadow, waiting to pounce. Why have the monsters born or reborn in past centuries continued to have such a hold on our imaginations? How have they become handy metaphoric ways of describing the dark side of ourselves, as well as epithets to hurl at our enemies as heartless automatons or predatory bloodsuckers or mindless animals all bent on our destruction? The monsters are before us in both senses. They seem to come from a dark past, but they stand in front of us every day. Two linked impulses moved me to write Haunted, both of which have infused my work since the start. The first is to connect elements in a culture without recourse to a hierarchy of high and low, the soft aesthetic values versus the hard political and economic ones. The second is to explore how emotions themselves can have a history. Haunted is thus very much akin to my earlier books, The Frenzy of Renown, On the History of Fame and the Desire to be Known, and From Chivalry to Terrorism, On the Changing Relationship Between War and Ideas of Masculinity. It takes a cultural phenomenon that seems to be of the present. Here the hordes of zombies, vampires, monsters, and other figures that crowd contemporary culture, and seeks to show not only that it has a history, but also how it has evolved. Why it is that these terrifying figures have been so endlessly present since the days of the 18th century political revolutions and the optimism of the Industrial Revolution, when it seemed that politics based on reason and knowledge based on empirical science would have been expected to vanquish such phantasms from human consciousness forever. Instead, those fears grew and expanded to furnish a continuing contradiction to and commentary upon the ambitions, assertions, and perhaps pretensions of the modern world itself. Haunted shares with Frenzy and Chivalry the conviction that a knowledge of history is crucial for understanding many of those connections that otherwise seem a matter of timeless emotions. The connection to religion and our deepest beliefs, even among the unreligious, about chance, nature, the past, the inner life, and life after death. Through the distorted prism of horror, Haunted considers not just the invariable elements of fear, but also how fear is shaped, as well as how those images warp our politics and our understanding of the world. In part, my goal is to foster a historical and cultural understanding of the idea of the monstrous as a way of freeing ourselves from the unconscious control of images otherwise rooted in our childhood apprehension of the world of darkness and invisible powers. I don't want to minimize the emotional attraction of these images, or banish them from rational discourse. I want to understand their attraction, as well as the incessant combat between reason and emotion in ourselves and in our public life. Fear is the pervasive topic of our times. Neuroscientists discuss it in terms of brain function. Sociologists and anthropologists investigate it in terms of social attitudes. Horror fans luxuriate in its monster shapes and its film and literary history. Politicians manipulate it. This book, in great part, deals with the evolution of a repertoire of monsters and monstrous images that come ready to hand as ways of understanding not only what is abnormal, what is to be hated and despised, but also what is compelling in its supernatural allure. It is commonplace to say that monsters and phantasms have always haunted human dreams, but I am interested here in those historical moments when the scattered fears of the past coalesce into more pervasive terrors, when the old stories meet new circumstances that expand and intensify their meaning. Many times in the course of my discussion, I have touched on issues that take up several library shelves, whether in religion, law, literature, science, and elsewhere. Many of these areas of study are controversial, and their authors are often a confusing but heady mixture of the academic, the fan, and the believer. As much as I could within the compass of my argument, I have tried to absorb the insights of scholarship as well as enthusiasm, without delving excessively into often fascinating disputes that in themselves are well worth exploring. In its discussion of the relation of horror to religion, for example, Haunted is not so much about the intricate historical investigations that have taken place into the nature of belief in demons versus the rarefied realm of demonological theory. Instead, it considers how those long-ago arguments have created a reservoir of imagery that continues to shape our popular culture and is drawn upon freely when paranoia and crisis again distort our sense of reality. Henry James once observed, "Really, universally, relations stop nowhere, and the exquisite problem of the artist is eternally but to draw, by a geometry of his own, the circle in which they shall happily appear to do so." The problem is the same, if not more acute, for the historian, especially the cultural historian, for what is not connected to innumerable other incidents, events, and trends? Like most historians, I am frustrated about the details I must leave out, the books I have consulted that there is no occasion to mention, and the illustrations I don't have the room to include. But a book must begin and end somewhere. So here I have fashioned a structure that I hope will suggest the many ways literature and art shape a primal emotion like fear into a variety of specific formulas. When I cite some works rather than others, therefore, I am sure some listeners will wonder where their favorites are and be able to add their own nuances. Haunted is therefore best seen as an effort to establish a basic taxonomy of fears, the times in which they arose and their perpetuation down to the present. Like a roadmap, as you move closer, you discover more and more details, even while you retain what I hope will be a useful sense of its basic patterns. Thinking about these issues began for me many years ago, in the 1960s, when the questioning of hierarchies of all sorts was in the air. It was helped immeasurably by conversations with some of my colleagues at Columbia University, including Sack Van Berkovich, Morris Dickstein, Edward Said, George Stade, and Mike Wood, and continued at Johns Hopkins with Sharon Cameron, Stanley Fish, Jerry McGann, Stephen Orgel, Lee Patterson, and Barry Weller. Some years I spent teaching a class at the University of Southern California called The Monster and the Detective, helped me work out and refine many of the ideas found here. I would also like to thank Hans Otto Hügel for printing some of my preliminary thoughts on horror in his Handbuch Populäre Kultur, Metzler Verlag 2003, as well as Amy Wallace, Del Howison, and Scott Bradley, for including my comments on horror films in The Book of Lists, Horror, HarperCollins, 2008. My interest in theology was first kindled at Swarthmore College with Linwood Urban and continued later with the works of Peter Brown, Elaine Pagels, and Karen Armstrong, among others. Nowhere in what follows do I specifically cite the work of my old friend Marina Warner, but the spirit of her unique mingling of myth, poetry, and insightful analysis was another inspiration. More recently, I've had valuable discussions with Jonathan Kirsch and with Jack Miles, to whom I owe special thanks for his astute and useful comments on a previous draft of the manuscript. Sandra Dykstra and Elise Capron at the Sandra Dykstra Literary Agency have smoothed the way with their usual engagement and efficiency. I was pleased to be in contact with Eric Brandt at Yale University Press for the early stages. When he left for Northern California and Stanford, I was delighted to have the luck of working with Steve Wasserman, an old friend from Los Angeles, now flourishing vigorously in both the East and the West. Eva Skews, his immensely talented and able editorial assistant, has been a tremendous help in moving the project forward. Finally, to complete the round of happy and fortuitous connections, I want to thank my friends and colleagues at the Los Angeles Institute for the Humanities, which Steve co-founded some years ago, and before whom I presented an early and brief version of Haunted. Everyone had interesting comments to make, but I remember especially those of John Boorstin, Clifford Johnson, Tom Lutz, John Romano, Mark Swed, and Lori Weiner. For help in gathering the illustrations, I thank Alan Jutze and Anita Weaver at the Henry E. Huntington Library, Shannon Supple, Christina Bodnar Anderson, and Charles James at the University of California Berkeley Library, Tyson Gaskill at the University of Southern California Library, Ian Calderwood at the British Museum, Karen Lurheim and Ova Kvavik at the Munch Museum, Oslo, Norway, and David Dees. Chapter 1. Shaping Fear. We love to be at once miserable and unhurt. Edward Young, Conjectures on Original Composition, 1759. We are all monsters in our subconscious. That's why we have laws and religion. Forbidden Planet, 1956. What makes us afraid? What terrifying shapes do we give to the darkness under the bed, or the odd noise in the closet, the illegal immigrant, or the terrorist? What makes us afraid as individuals, afraid as groups, afraid as nations? The question of fear is not just a question solely of individual response, the peculiarities of personal strengths and weaknesses. It is also, and perhaps even more immediately, a question about how a culture responds to events, what names we call what scares us, and how those names help determine how we respond. When I was a child, that name was Hitler. Even though he had been dead for some years and I was barely 10 years old, I had simultaneous fantasies of being attacked by him and then defeating him. For some later 10-year-olds, that name might have been Osama bin Laden. For other peoples in other parts of the world, with other fears, it might be the great Satan of the United States, a Hamas rocket, or an Israeli soldier. Fears may summon up a tentacled, non-human monster with ravenous teeth, a rampaging robot, or the boy next door turned into a zombie. When a mysterious thing happens, we first try to understand it in terms and images we already have learned and internalized for assessing mystery. What's in the closet? What's under the bed? Who is the boogeyman? They are all shifting questions, inflected by history and culture. For Odysseus and his shipmates, monsters could be man-eaters like the giant Polyphemus or the sirens, female monsters enticing men to their deaths by their alluring songs. For English Protestants, the monster was the many-headed Hydra of the Catholic Church. For Catholics, the diabolic reforms of Martin Luther, John Calvin, and others. There are monsters in the ages before us, and monsters right in front of us, and often those new monsters wear the shapes of the old. So my question about the nature of fear must be expanded to include time. What is the relation between what scares us now and what scared people in the past? Is being afraid something that is hardwired into human nature and never varies over the centuries? Do fears always take the same shapes, or do nations and cultures have distinctive fears that may metamorphose through the centuries? In other words, what is universal about fear, and what is culturally specific in its images and stories? What belongs to a certain era, and what transcends time? What is the process by which nameless dreads are named? Fear indeed might be a reasonable response to potential danger, an emotion to be stimulated and manipulated, an enlivener of action that allows us to take risks, or a stifler of action that encourages a frozen immobility before a threat. Aristotle defined virtue as the midpoint of two vices. Could fear, by the same reasoning, be the midpoint between paranoia and apathy? Might, in some situations, fear be a virtue? Does religion need fear to retain its power? Does morality? Many fears are personal. But when does personal fear become the fear of a whole locality, like the belief that the aristocracy was causing bad harvests in the early French Revolution? And when does it expand to become a national fear, like the paranoia of Cold War America, let alone a worldwide fear? Surely the expansion of media fuels fear just as it enhances gossip and every other sort of simulated human contact. As the neuroscientist Antonio Damasio has argued, innate behaviors like fear, anger, or disgust require circumstances to give them shape. He uses the phrase switched on, which has a more mechanistic air than the rest of his argument implies, to describe the process by which emotional potentials in individual nature become feelings when they are shaped by the personal and cultural stories in which they make their appearance. My favorite example of this process is how, for many years, the stereotype of a person with delusions of grandeur has been that he believed he was Napoleon. But who did such a person believe he was before Napoleon existed? As Ichiko Iwasaka and Bar Token have written about Japanese ghost legends, such stories also seem to dramatize areas of doubt, ambiguity, anxiety, and concern which are not addressed by scientific means, matters involving human emotions which are strongly connected to cultural values, but for which there are no clear answers. Humans have been afraid since we first gathered around campfires at night to tell stories of the inhabitants of the darkness that stalked just beyond the edge of light. And some have theorized that that fear of the dark, say, is a vestige of the caveman's fear of lurking predators. But that kind of paralyzing fear doesn't seem very conducive to alertness or any other skills the caveman might have needed to survive. Even if fear were a survival mechanism, where does the pleasure in being scared come from? The shivering delight so many take in listening to spooky stories and going to horror films? In the tale of terror, whatever form it takes, we are pulled down the hallway to the door we don't want to open, to see what we have been warned not to see. Curiosity and dread pull us back and forth until curiosity finally wins. We search out the monstrous in hopes that it won't find us unawares. We peer into the darkened recesses, always knowing something horrible may jump out, even from inside ourselves, like the dark side of Dr. Jekyll, released in the form of Mr. Hyde, or the gibbering extraterrestrial baby with needle-sharp teeth that bursts from the chest of one of the crewmen in the film Alien. What lies behind that door that has to be opened, now finally unlocked? Are we always optimistically running from complacency and toward curiosity? And is the apparition of the monstrous then the punishment for our overweening desire to know? The traditional Freudian interpretation was that behind that closed door is the primal scene of parental sexuality. Certainly, the dark world of horror has an intimate relation to erotic secrecy, but it is obviously limiting to say that, of course, it's always sex behind the door. The appeal of opening that door is fueled by curiosity, a taste to experience the marvelous, the possibility of unearthing otherwise hidden knowledge that can now finally be revealed and perhaps then understood and controlled. The inner environment of the body and the mind, where feelings are hatched and fears can fester, thus has a close relation with the outside world. All three elements in the complex equation of reality, the individual human brain and body, the tangible world around it, and the larger but less visible world of cultural context, each plays its role. As civilization developed and knowledge of the physical world expanded, the monster was at first pushed more and more to the periphery of consciousness, like the blank spaces on old maps where the only information is the legend, here there be dragons, or the so-called babawins, grotesque figures that decorate the margins of medieval manuscripts and appear sculpted on churches. Monsters tended to be somewhere else. They were met by Odysseus on his journeys back to home and Penelope. They popped up in travelers' tales of the exotic places of the earth, or they held a mythic, godlike status, like the jackal-headed Anubis of Egypt or the bull-headed Minotaur of Crete. Often they were less real, less likely to be met on an evening's walk in the woods than they were symbolic. Like the dragon that St. George defeated, or the Medusa from whom Perseus snatched Andromeda, they were fully formed, but also somewhat abstract, strange beasts already primed to be interpreted by priests and scholars as the embodiment of evil, irreligion, and whatever local enemy was at hand. In the age of movies and an expansive popular culture, we have populated the medieval world with monsters of all sorts, flying dragons, comical ogres, wood demons, as well as created pseudo-medieval worlds like those of J.R.R. Tolkien, J.K. Rowling, and Philip Pullman. But in the actual Middle Ages, even when the Orthodox suspected there were witches in league with Satan, there were also good witches to whom one could apply to neutralize their evil spells, cure a sickness, or restore the crops, and the humans, to fertility and abundance. In these centuries before electric lights, darkness was more familiar, although often more terrifying, and the invisible world in which witches specialized could be invoked for good as well as evil. Or so it seemed, until the 16th and 17th centuries, when Satan's presence in the world began to be felt more palpably, and the number of witch trials and trials for blasphemy and heresy quickly reached epidemic proportions. Especially in the wake of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation of the mid-16th century, the destruction of religious icons in England and the establishment of the Inquisition in Spain, an atmosphere of apprehension, fear, and dread suffused Europe, in which the enemy kingdom of Satan was a handy substitute for the enemy religion, whether Catholic or Protestant. In England, particularly, Protestants felt under siege, first from Catholic Spain and later from Catholic France. The conspiracy of Guy Fawkes and his Catholic co-conspirators to blow up the Houses of Parliament in 1605 heightened an already existing paranoia about Catholics that grew throughout the 17th century and beyond. In part, this widespread anxiety was based on the reasonable belief that Louis XIV, the most powerful monarch in Europe, was masterminding both political and religious pressure on his rivals, and in part it was fueled by the fabrications of some Protestants whose own fears impelled them to exaggerate the threat. Three centuries later, a similar mixture of reasonable fears and paranoia is often directed against Islam. As is the case now, in the 17th and 18th centuries, old certainties and old remedies to cure the impotence of fear seemed useless. Old religions were being questioned, and the power of evil seemed more all-consuming than ever before. Just as medieval Christianity had redefined the gods of the old religions of Northern Europe, Odin, Thor, Freya, as fiends and demons, many Protestants considered Catholics to be the spawn of Satan, and Catholics often returned the favor. What had been in the more monolithic world of medieval Catholicism a difficult but practicable commerce between the world of material reality and the world of the intangible spirit became instead a polarized opposition in which Catholics and Protestants competed as experts in the invisible world of faith. Into this unsettled realm walked the monster, the quintessence of all fears. For an Elizabethan royalist like Edmund Spenser, the monster might have been called Archimago, the Catholic master of false appearances. For a nonconformist Protestant allegorist like John Bunyan, the monster might be the giant despair who lives in Doubting Castle, lying in wait to catch the wandering Christian as he strays from his faith. While the independent Protestant John Milton, in his epic poem Paradise Lost, described the mythic monsters and gods of paganism as warped and distorted perceptions of an underlying Christian truth. These monsters from the past, like Milton's description of Dagon, sea monster, upward man, and downward fish, came principally from the fertile imaginations of the writers, engravers, carvers, and painters who attempted to depict the enemies of the Christian world, especially during the Middle Ages. Some of those images in mutated forms persist down to the present as dragons or sea monsters. Others were so dependent upon the culture that gave them birth that they remain only as trivia questions or inspiration for the special effects of the latest horror movie. If we, say, don't live in a culture haunted by the fear of what happens after the heroics of the battlefield, or in one in which the fear of vengeful warrior women is not so high, what need is there of the half-woman, half-bird harpy to rend the warrior's flesh, or the half-bird, half-woman Valkyrie to carry him off to Valhalla? Our own anxieties about gender and sexuality, chiefly in the wake of wars that separated the sexes, fashion instead such figures as the vamp of the 1920s, and later the femme fatale of film noir, seeming modern figures, but with their roots in the ancient past. It is often easy enough to find ancient origins for contemporary monsters and conclude they have always been with us. But the more interesting question is why monsters lie quiescent in some ages and in others crowd the imagination. Each age has its own particular fears, and the history of horror is the history of the disquiets of the soul, the inner life made public, taking on the colorations of the era in which they appear. I will therefore touch on the prehistory of the monstrous and the many worldwide beliefs in gods and demons when they become relevant. But this book is not particularly about the longevity of human fears. It focuses instead on two eras. The first, that of the grand rupture in Christianity between Catholicism and Protestantism, that revives so many of the fears that created the monsters of the past. And the second, a few centuries before our own, in which the shape of fear, theologically, politically, culturally, literarily, and artistically, became an integral part of the books we read, the images we see, the enemies we have, and the beliefs we hold. Of course, there are similarities between, say, the ghosts imagined by the Greeks and the Romans and those who walk the earth in more recent centuries, although more modern monsters like zombies have hardly such long-lived genealogies, while otherwise extremely local monsters like the Vrikolakas, vampires of Eastern Europe and the Balkans, have been transformed by the need for new stories into beings more extravagant than anything in their folktale origins. It is exactly that evolution, and how it came about, that most interests me. The modern monster, the most direct ancestor of our own fears and pleasures, does not really make his, and sometimes her, appearance until the later 18th century. It was the era of the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution, when reason was being invoked to clarify and solve human social problems, and people could look around themselves every day and see the palpable indications that things had changed. Practical discoveries and inventions were coming thick and fast, and international wise men like Voltaire, Rousseau, and Franklin were acknowledged models of the high aspirations of human thought. Yet into this world so bright, so optimistic, and so convinced of its progress toward a grand future, came a cataclysmic event which seemed to mock the limits of human understanding and control of the natural world, while at the same time, particularly for Christian believers, it raised the possibility that perhaps God's plan for the world was not entirely benevolent. Read My Apocalypse. In the early morning of November 1st, 1755, a devastating earthquake and tsunami destroyed much of Lisbon, the capital of Portugal, killing between 10,000 and 100,000 people. Since the parting of the Red Sea, few natural events have had such an impact on the way people interpret the world. The effects of the earthquake were, in fact, felt all over Europe and even in the Caribbean. But because of the extreme destruction and the numerous ways people tried to...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?